We hope and trust that you will find this Torah in Motion program meaningful. Through these programs, Torah in Motion encourages discussion, debate, and education about the most important issues facing Jews and Judaism today. Together, we can focus on creating religious commitment through an honest and sophisticated encounter with topics that are relevant to being Jewish in the modern world. For more information about this and other Torah in Motion programs, please visit the website at www.torahinmotion.org.
You didn't tell me when I should stop, though.
You'll tell me. Okay. That's the right answer. That's the right answer. I wanted to talk about prenuptial agreements. And we'll move from prenuptial agreements to visions of reality in the field of marriage itself. In Talmudic times, the aguna problem at its centrality focused on an aguna problem that I used to say has disappeared, which is husbands who vanished. And I've spent my last month having to deal with husbands who have vanished, and it brings me up to New York now almost every week to hear aguna cases of the Talmudic type. But centrally, the modern day aguna problem has been fixed. The Talmudic aguna problem has been fixed in modern times. Technology has advanced to the point where it is exceedingly difficult to disappear without a trace. It's exceedingly difficult to die without a trace. And thus, even though there are thousands of tragic deaths in the World Trade Center, I go up to New York every week. You go down to New York, I go up to New York every week, and I hear cases involving men who disappeared, and all of the cases get resolved over time because eventually every single person, some form of evidence is produced demonstrating that they were in the Kibshon Ha'esh when it exploded. Thus the classical Talmudic Aguna Shaila has been profoundly ameliorated such that husbands rarely leave their wives without evidence of their death. And we are blessed by that. Technology changes reality frequently to make it better. This is such a case. Thus, there were no agunot at the end of World War II, because we could say with a high degree of confidence that anybody who didn't report their way into a DP camp, a displaced person camp, was dead. And that's the view taken by Rav Moshe Feinstein. That's the view taken by the Chazon Ish. That's the view taken by Rav Herzog. And all of the contemporary poskim have recognized that centrally the Talmudic Aguna Shaila, which is the husband who's disappeared, is over. And we're blessed by that. We should count our blessings. What has happened in modern times is a very different type of Aguna question. It's a question that's really, the Talmudic rabbis couldn't have envisioned for many different reasons. The modern Aguna question involves husbands and wives who are getting divorced, who can't agree on the terms of divorce, and because they can't agree on the terms of the divorce, typically the husband and occasionally the wife will withhold the giving or the receiving of a get, and they will become recalcitrant. intentionally withholding a get from their wife, occasionally husband, so as to induce better terms of settlement. This has nothing to do with the Talmudic Aguna case. It is a term that's misused for the absence of a better term. In English, we really want to call these husbands recalcitrant rather than lost. And we've been struggling for the last many years with how to fix the problem of recalcitrant husbands. And it's a serious problem that gnaws at the centrality of the Jewish ethical mind. This problem is at its core a manifestation of modernity, in the sense that in times when the Beit Din system was in power and had jurisdiction over the lives of Jews, the Beit Din system used various techniques to impose upon the husband or the wife the obligation to give or receive a get. Sometimes they simply ordered the giving or the receiving of a get under the pain of physical punishment. Even when they couldn't or wouldn't do that, they frequently ordered the husband to pay support until such time as he was divorced from his wife Jewishly. And the support level was set, as is the takanat ha-ga'onim, the decree of the ga'onim, at increasingly high levels as time goes along, reflecting the increasing needs of the wife for maintenance and support as her marriage breaks down. And this, too, was designed to impose upon the husband incentives to divorce, because according to Jewish law, husband is required to support his wife. And if he wishes to get out of that duty of support, there is only one easy way to do so, and that's to end the marriage. And you can end your marriage through death, or you can end your marriage through divorce, whichever one wishes. And that's the truth, whichever one wishes. One comes by choice, the other does not. And the Beit Din in Europe, the Pesachei Tshuva and Ebenezer says this repeatedly. When a husband said, I don't want to divorce you, and the wife said, I want to be divorced, Beit Din said, you did not in any way, shape, or form have to divorce your wife, but you have to continue to support her, even as she lived out of the house. And they continuously upped the level of support. And if you fell behind on your level of support, they threw you in prison because you were behind in a financial obligation, or they took away your stuff, and eventually you got the message, which was that if you didn't want to continuously pay, you should be divorced. And once you're divorced, you don't have to pay support because you don't have to support your ex-wife. And this was the historic mechanism of addressing the Aguna problem. For reasons that are twofold, this system failed in America. First, it failed in America because the Beis Din system itself has failed in America. Other than few and far between Batei Din, of which I pride myself in being affiliated with one of them, the Batei Din generally don't enjoy the confidence and support of the community, and they're not staffed by Dayanim who reflect the economic and social reality of the community that they're in. To successfully resolve financial disputes, you need to understand the commercial construct that people do business under. And thus, you can be an eminent Talmud Chacham, and I make no bones about my own qualifications. There are many more learned people than I. Everybody at YU knows this. My only claim in life is that I have a certain amount of dual system expertise, and that I live intensely in more than one world, and I understand how business is done. To run a successful Beit Din system, you have to be attuned to the financial norms of community, you have to be attuned to the marital norms of a community, you have to figure out how to address cases where the social reality is not the same as in Talmudic times. Few Batei Din exist that do that, and that was one root cause of the abandonment of the Beit Din system. The second is the expansion of secular law, so that now everybody is married and divorced according to secular law, and to impose upon people an additional requirement of Jewish law requires that people leap through two hoops in order to get divorced. Now, we leap through two hoops in order to get married, you understand. In order to get married, you have to be both civilly married and halakhically married, but why don't people complain about both of those hoops? First of all, we do it at once. And second of all, when you're in love, hoop jumping is fun. No, it's very important to understand that when you're in love, doing these things together is enjoyable. Divorce is dramatically different than marriage for two reasons. The secular government will not let the clergy who marry you divorce you. So even though you can go to a rabbi to get married, you cannot go to that rabbi to get divorced. Divorce is limited in the United States to the explicit judicial authority of the court system. Second of all, people find divorce, secular divorce, to be burdensome and unpleasant and difficult and antagonistic. And jumping through two unpleasant, difficult hoops is twice as unpleasant. So the Beit Din system has a very hard time imposing its own vision of divorce on the community. The solution to both of these problems, which incidentally solves the Aguna problem, is already noted by the Nachlas Shiva. The Nachlas Shiva was a student of the Taz, the Turei Zav. I'm not a historian, but I think he died in the early 1600s, 1610, and he proposes that people should sign an agreement in which the husband and the wife promise, should either one leave the house, that the one who leaves improperly will pay support to the one who stays. This is called, broadly speaking, Tosefis Mazonis, additional support. Starting around 15 years ago, Rabbi Willig and a number of others, I was a mere student when this got started, started to advocate the following solution to the Aguna problem. People should sign prenuptial agreements incorporating the Nachlas Sheva's approach, adding to it a submission agreement which will be accepted by American law. The essence of these submission agreements say as follows. Husband and wife agree that should they get divorced, they agree to submit all of their disputes or all of their subsets of disputes to the following Beit Din, and you have to name the Beit Din, and husband and wife agrees, typically worded in a very specific way because of the requirements of secular law, that until a Jewish divorce is given, maintenance shall be paid by the husband to the wife to the tune of $100 a day, which is taken in the United States to be daily support. Given the value of the Canadian dollar, it's a much higher number here than it is in America. But whatever exactly the number is, the blank line fills in what it takes to support a person for a day or a week living their own life. In New York, it's taken to be about $100 or $150 a day. In Atlanta, I never write more than $100 a day. Perhaps it's as high as $200 Canadian in Toronto. And when the husband and wife separate, and one refuses to give a get to the other invokes the prenuptial agreement, which requires the payment of support until a get is given. The prenuptial agreement always works. What do I mean by that? Although you can craft many nightmarish scenarios, prenuptial agreements are like seatbelts. When I was a little boy, I had an incredible educational experience with a state trooper who came to my fifth grade class. He said that he's unbuckled many people from car accidents. He's never unbuckled a dead person. Okay? And he's pulled many dead people out of cars who are not wearing seatbelts. I sit on Dine Torah all the time. I have a caseload of perhaps 50 Dine Torah a year. I fly up to New York very frequently. I've never sat on a case in which a woman did not receive a get promptly, in which she had a prenuptial agreement governing the end of her marriage. Does that mean you cannot construct cases where it's problematic? You can. Just like wearing a seatbelt is a bad idea if you get into a car accident and then your car plunges into the water, and so being tied down to your car, and then the seatbelt jams. So of course, you can create a construct in which wearing a seatbelt is bad. It's rare. And in the totality of the statistical picture, so rare that it never happens. I've never sat on a Din Torah, and I've never been involved in an Aguna matter in which there was a prenuptial agreement in which a get wasn't given pronto. Now, you know, sometimes a woman says, I want to get today. It doesn't happen today because, you know what? Nothing happens that fast. But I've never sat on a case in which there was a prenuptial agreement in which the woman waited more than 6 months for a get. Okay, which is inevitably less time than it took for her civil divorce. So the system works really well. But you know what's the scary thing about the system? It doesn't work if you use it only when you need it. The prenuptial agreements are vaccines. Vaccines are useful only if you take them when you have no inclination that you might be ill. If you start taking your smallpox vaccine after you've been exposed, it's too late. Husband and wife cannot agree on the text of a prenup when they start fighting, because then inevitably each party looks into the prenup to determine what's in their best interest, given their own set of fights. Instead, what you have to do is you have to impose prenuptial agreements on vast segments of society so as to mandate that everybody use prenuptial agreements, even though you turn to every single person and say, this won't affect you because you will have a happy marriage. But some people it might affect, and we don't really know in advance who it will affect and who it won't, and thus we have to push for everybody to use them because they really, really, really do work. Now, the specific prenuptial agreement that the Orthodox Caucus uses is in fact ill-suited to use in Canada. And so I'm not here to tell you to use that prenuptial agreement for both reasons relating to Canadian law and reasons relating to the fact that there are two different agreements. This particular agreement is not well-suited in Canada, but drafting an agreement that's well-suited in Canada is easy. It's not hard. And there are a number of different visions and versions of prenuptial agreements, each of which has its own upside and downside. But it's important to understand, like the many different polio vaccines, frequently whether you took the Salk or the Sabin vaccine hardly mattered so long as you took something. And the people who said, I don't know whether I should use the Salk polio vaccine or the Sabin polio vaccine, so I won't be vaccinated, you know what they were doing? They were making a mistake. There are a number of prenuptial agreements out there that can readily be adopted to the Canadian construct. The simple prenuptial agreement which says husband and wife agree that within 30 days of the civil divorce, husband agrees to give wife a get. And husband agrees that if he doesn't give wife a get within 30 days of the civil divorce, he will submit the giving and receiving of a get and the payment of support to a Beit Din made up of rabbis A, B, and C. It's a very simple six-line prenuptial agreement that's highly effective in the United States that have laws similar to Canada's. It happens that that's not New York State, and it's not New Jersey, and it's not Georgia, and it's not Florida, but it is California. And there are five or six fine prenuptial agreements out there, each a little bit different, each having its own set of ups and downs. And by the way, this prenuptial agreement doesn't work at all in Israel. How come? Because there's no civil divorce. So to make your giving of a get contingent on a civil divorce in Israel is silly, because you're in essence announcing that you'll never ever get a get, because you're making a contingent on something that will never ever happen. So, and in Israel, there's yet another prenuptial agreement that they use. Also, the Beis Din distributes it. There are a variety of different prenuptial agreements, each of which has their own little twist. But, I always tell people something that other members of the Beis Din find funny, because we've worked to craft these prenuptial agreements with a great deal of care. It doesn't matter which one you use. Okay? Because almost all of the agreements cover almost all of the same matters identically. It's only little details that differ from one to another. The use of any prenuptial agreement is a highly effective, very successful solution to the Aguna problem. As I sit on more and more Dine Torah, I've become mean-spirited. And it's a very serious failing. And I've begun to turn to people who come to me in the course of Dine Torah. They've been married for 9 months and they're getting divorced and there's no prenuptial agreement. And I feel like turning them away because they complain bitterly about the process. And I say, well, why didn't you have a prenuptial agreement? And they say, well, it wasn't relevant to me because I was never going to get divorced. Here they are, not ever going to celebrate their first wedding anniversary. And I feel like saying to them, well, you know, you've become a statistic. And it shouldn't make you have any comfort, but you should be aware of the fact that there's a lesson that you should share with your friends. The Aguna problem is not a problem of either rabbinic will or halachic way. There are cases that fit into that, but this is not one of them. The Aguna problem, there is both a rabbinic will and a halachic way to solve. It requires, however, something that's even more difficult than either rabbinic will or halachic way. It requires congregants stepping forward to do things in advance. And that this is very hard. This is very hard. You know, rabbis as a whole, I find, are a group that thinks about the long term. Congregants, on the other hand, don't. Why is that so? Because rabbis see many life cycle events, and they begin to realize the reality of divorce. I'm a very bad rabbi because I've done hundreds and hundreds of divorces and only 17 marriages. I've been misader hundreds of gittin, and I very rarely do marriages. I have the smallest of the shuls in Atlanta with the ugliest social hall, and so the other rabbi does all the marriages, even of my congregants, which is fine. I do the divorces of his congregants. That's right, so much nachas from one. Well, he says that he has a much better relationship with my congregation than I have with his, because his congregation comes to me and they get divorced, and my congregation goes to him to get married. Congregants, however, when they come to, rabbis see many marriages and many divorces, and thus they understand that marriages end in divorce. Congregants don't see this. And what it takes to introduce prenuptial agreements is not rabbinic will or a halachic way. It requires congregants imposing upon each other the need for prenuptial agreements. And people say, well, why can't the rabbis do it? And I need to give you a very important answer. What makes America, and I suspect Canada, great, is that rabbis are essentially powerless. This is a dramatic change from Europe. We have emasculated the rabbinate, given it very little substantive authority outside of the domain of the synagogue itself. We don't want rabbis telling us what to do, and we don't want rabbis regulating our life outside of the synagogue itself. And having emasculated the rabbinate, people are complaining about its impotency. And, congregants, in Rabbi Norman Lamb's immortal words, get the rabbinate that they deserve. And it's a very important observation. Having decided that we don't want rabbis to tell them, am I striking close to home in your shul also? But I say this to you in all honesty. We don't really want rabbis telling us how to live our lives. That's been the truth in America. And thus, we're not prepared to listen to rabbis telling us what to do. And here, the rabbis have a solution. The congregants aren't listening. I fight with congregants all the time about prenuptial agreements. The congregants don't listen to me. And they don't want to listen to me. And furthermore, we've created a structure where they don't have to listen to me, which is fine. But then you have to realize that the onus on solving the Aguna problem doesn't rest on the shoulders of the rabbinate. The onus rests on congregants who need to go around saying, our synagogue, as a matter of lay leadership, won't allow weddings to be performed in our building without a prenuptial agreement. And we won't allow our rabbi to perform weddings without a prenuptial agreement. To say, rabbi, you should impose this on your congregants, is an act of rabbinic suicide, because congregants Rabbis are employees. Rabbis are employees. I feel blessed in my own shul where I'm not really an employee, and I quit every year and make them reelect me. No, I do. As a matter of policy, I quit every year and I make the shul board vote to reaffirm that I should stay on as the rabbi. But I have a full-time job in a university that requires very little work and that pays me, so I don't really worry. I feel blessed. I feel blessed by it. But it's a very important motif. You can't ask rabbis to fight with congregants over the sociology of the community. You can't ask it of them. To do that, you need to create much stronger rabbis with much firmer contracts. And it's just not on the horizon in America. Rabbis get lifetime contracts when they, you know, turn 70 or become terminally ill. That's how you get a lifetime contract. Laugh as you will. I say this to you in deadly earnestness and seriousness. If we want to solve the Aguna problem in America, it gets solved bottom up and not top down. And it gets solved bottom up by congregants going to board meetings and saying that we will not allow weddings in our synagogue without a prenuptial agreement. And we won't allow our rabbi, who's our employee, to do a wedding anywhere without a prenuptial agreement. And that this is not a matter of halacha. This is a matter of sociology of our community. And that the rabbis can't impose this top-down for many, many, many different reasons. And it's too much to ask. If you want bizarre, far-fetched solutions to the Aguna problem, they can be imposed top-down, but they're all far out on the halachic limb and will inevitably prove profoundly divisive of community and, in the end, unsuccessful, because we are committed to solving the Aguna problem in a way that diminishes rather than increases schism in the community. And if we want to fix the Aguna problem bottom up, it comes through communal action that leads congregants in directions that the rabbis think the community ought to go. So I can tell you the truth, which is in my little shul in Atlanta, where I'm a very powerful rabbi. I'm a very powerful rabbi in my small shul, but it's a very small shul, so I'm the big fish in a very small pond, and I make everybody sign prenuptial agreements. People tell me they won't. I tell them that they're no longer members of the synagogue. Okay? And you know what happens? They leave, which doesn't bother me at all because I want to run a small shul that makes me happy. But it comes from the fact that I have another job and I have a very different model of how I want to run a shul. If you want to do this throughout the land in the Orthodox community, this occurs by congregants pushing for it with rabbinic support. So I say to you a very important lesson. There's a motif in America of blaming the rabbinate. And it's a common motif, but it's not really true here. The truth is that the rabbis have a simple, useful, highly successful tool that brings the Aguna problem down to zero. You know, when people use prenuptial agreements regularly, there will still be occasional cases of Igun. What's a case of Igun? I'm dealing with such a case now. A man went out on a car accident. He went out for a drive, he hit his head in a car accident, and he's permanently demented, but not in the least bit sick. Now, his wife is an Aguna. Demented means crazy, these guys. He's crazy. He's in a sanatorium. He thinks he's somebody else. Okay, he's demented. He thinks he's his father. It's very sad and scary, and he's in a sanatorium. And his wife is an Aguna. I don't have tools for fixing this problem. We have a list of small tools, some of which we'll use, but there will still be Aguna problems. But you know what they'll be? One in a million. There'll be one in a million cases. Right now, in a society without prenuptial agreements, my rough estimate is A third of the people who go through a halachic divorce are held up in some way, shape, or form over the giving or receiving of a get. And that number can be cut from 1 in 3 to 1 in 10,000 with the use of a prenuptial agreement. But you can't use your prenuptial agreement when you realize you're getting divorced. You have to use it when you're still in love. So I turn to you and say a very simple message. And, you know, I've made you laugh a number of times, but the message isn't at all funny. The message is a very serious one. This is not a rabbinic problem, and this is not a halachic problem. This is a congregational problem. Congregants hate this because they want the rabbi to fix all of the problems painlessly. And this is not a problem that can be fixed by the rabbis. It can be fixed painlessly. To fix it painlessly, communities have to agree that everybody who gets married uses a prenuptial agreement, and it's no reflection on you because we all use it. And it has to become a standard tool, no different than a ksuva, or no different than a marriage license, or no different than a whole host of other things that we routinely impose upon people simply so that everybody should do so. It's no different than that which we hope, which is an AIDS vaccine. Were there to be an AIDS vaccine, I would immunize my children, not because I expect that they need it, but because it can't hurt. And if you say the only people who should take an AIDS vaccine are the people who need it, all those who need it, please step forward. What happens? Nobody steps forward. How come? Because that's the nature of sociology. The people who need to be vaccinated against AIDS, first and foremost at the head of the line, are the people who don't need the vaccine. So they will be guiding lights for everybody else. This is true for congregants in the context of prenuptial agreements. You want to do something positive when you get married. And when your children get married, even though they don't need it, use a prenuptial agreement and read it in public. Read it in public so that everybody should know that you're doing it and that that creates a sociology in which this is a norm. Shuls shouldn't allow weddings that don't have prenuptial agreements. And they should say to their rabbi that you can't. Now, why is it important to say to the rabbi? Because that way when the rabbi confronts a congregant who says, "Rabbi, I've been your loyal supporter for many years," the rabbi doesn't have to say, "Look, this is my own personal view." The rabbi can say, "Look, this is the policy of the synagogue, and I can't be pressed on this matter because they will fire me." And it's important to create a motif in which these rules are self-enforcing and self-policing. So I don't come to you here with a specific prenuptial agreement. I'd be glad to share with any number of you a text or two of a prenuptial agreement that works in Canada. But that's not the problem. It's neither a rabbinic will nor a halachic way problem. The central problem is congregants need to step forward and use them, and they need to use them publicly, and they need to use them in a way that persuades everybody to use them, not you need a prenuptial agreement because you're entering into a bad marriage. The moment that becomes the motif of prenuptial agreements, maybe you should have a prenuptial agreement because you're entering into a bad marriage, that immediately creates a motif in which most 20-year-olds will never sign one. And that's a very unsuccessful, sad, and scary sociology. So what's gnawing at the heart of orthodoxy is neither rabbinic will nor halachic way, but the social consequences of the community that we've built. And that's changed bottom up and not top down. I'm glad to answer any and all questions.
I only just read you about one thing that congregants hate this. I love what you're saying, and I think a lot of congregants will love it. And potentially, I like the idea of the rabbi saying, "What can I do? Congregation session?" So I just wanted to correct you on that one thing, but the...
What shul do you belong to?
The shul. Don't ask me what shul I belong to.
And is there a policy in the shul?
No, but... No.
Okay. Has it been raised at a board meeting?
I think Rabbi Marcus may be...
There are some rabbis who
try to impose it. I don't know anything about...
We'll take it.
we'll take it forward from here. My question to you is something a little step back. For years, I've blamed the rabbis, from what you're saying, I see that that was maybe the wrong direction to go. But blamed on two fronts. For when my friends go forward, and unfortunately, I've estimated recently maybe 10 close friends, 10 close couples who.
One of those are causals.
Yeah, I did start to wonder that after the.
I'm glad to keep going.
Friends in different cities.
Yeah. In recent years.
In the last 15 years.
Okay.
So, I always felt that the rabbis played a little role in either the, pre-divorce, in trying to help the marriage, or once they came to the rabbi and said, we've decided to divorce, I felt that the rabbis didn't do much in terms of reconciliation. I felt there was a certain amount of cowardice and really being willing to roll up your sleeves and get in there and help people. Just let me finish what I said. My question from what you're saying is that maybe this is something for congregants to help each other with more than rabbis, because people don't want rabbis to tell them what to do.
Okay, I think it's a very complicated sociology in the Western world for what is the proper role of the rabbi, and it's not such a simple thing. So I don't have answers for you. I don't perceive rabbis in America or Canada as having the same force, either practically, politically, or morally, as the rabbinate did in Europe. And so I don't...
Of course I'm talking about sympathy.
So I think that large numbers of people don't want to have a pastor. They want to have a posek. And you have to understand the difference between a pastor and a posek. I'm not the pastor to my flock. They're hardly a flock. I am a posek to many of them. I'm a posek to many people who are not at all members of my shul.
I don't think any of us want to put this all out onto marriage counseling.
Well, I don't have good answers. I don't have good answers for how to do this. Most people don't want to talk to the rabbi about these things. I don't have answers. My own skills are not pastoral, they're halachic. So I don't have answers. I answer many more halachic questions than I get from my congregants, but people don't ask, should I get divorced?
I just think that when people are having problems, the community ought to have they ought to have a sense that they can go to their friends.
Whenever a congregant comes to me and says, I'm having marital difficulties, can we talk? I clear my plate for these matters because they're very important. But lots of people get divorced without ever asking me to clear my plate until the time that it actually comes to see or get. Because they're not interested in my advice and whether they should get divorced or not.
They don't feel that. I think we have to make it more of an option.
Okay. Please.
I have three-part question. Two of them are on small points related to something you said. One is that an Orthodox rabbi will not perform a wedding unless a woman goes to the mikvah.
Is that true here?
How is this different?
Is that true here? I don't think that that's correct. I've performed 17 Orthodox weddings, and I've never asked any of the kollels whether they've gone to mikvah. I, to be honest, assume they all do, but I've never ever asked. Some of them I know.
Assumption that's not correct, your question.
Okay, I perform many weddings, and I certainly do not ask the kollels whether they go to mikvah. So I have no opinion one way or another on this. I've always assumed they do, but.
In Israel,
The law of the state requires it. We could have a different lecture on a different topic. The single most vile piece of anti-Semitism I've seen in my whole life was scrawled on a bridge in Yerushalayim. It said, "Rabbanim lezevel v'rabbanut lahashmada." And I was walking with a well-known Hezder Rosh Yeshiva, and he looked at me and said, that was written by some religious Jew trying to get permission to get married by the Rabbanut. Okay, and he couldn't get it to Udas Rav Akut, and he got angry. He was joking, but in Israel, the Rabbanut suffers from its own collection of problems. In America, certainly, rabbis don't require that women go to mikveh.
Okay, so that assumption not being correct, then as far as I'm concerned, I have no question on that score. Second thing is, contract is the agreement is tied to a particular date, a particular people who are part of the date.
There are many different ways to word it.
What happens if that Beit Din gets dissolved for some reason, or
so there are very simple ways to word these things. You can say a Beit Din chosen by the rabbi of Shari Shemayim, or its successor shul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what happens when Shari Shemayim disappears? So there'll be a successor shul. Most shuls don't just go out of business. It's easy, to the extent that you want to ask very technical questions about how will we pick the Beit Din, and there are lots and lots and lots of ways to write this sentence so that inevitably there's somebody to pick.
Okay, the third part of my question is, what about the opposition to the concept of prenuptial agreements that I understand but don't know for sure have been voiced by various segments of the Orthodox Church?
There is no halachic opposition to prenuptial agreements. There is a school of thought in the sociology of Orthodoxy which says that talking about divorce, like talking about cancer, makes it more likely. It's possible. I've always thought that the downsides of a prenuptial agreement are less than the upsides. This is a social context. Indeed, it's the congregants who induce a certain sociology, which is we don't talk about prenuptial agreements because it's an ayin hara. This is not. There is no rabbinic opposition to the types of prenuptial agreements that I've outlined to you. None. Zero. There is no published tshuvot against it. You don't find anybody maligning them halachically. You do find rabbis and communities saying, oh, this is only for the modern Orthodox community with its high divorce rate. But our community, where nobody gets divorced, and even when they do get divorced, they behave in a wonderful, loving, above-board, candid way. We don't need these agreements. Now, that's a vision of sociology that I wish were so. But I don't see any halachic opposition to prenuptial agreements.
The fact is that in Toronto, the shul with respect to the largest social hall and the more weddings are performed in this particular shul than any other, will not knowingly allow a wedding to take place in a shul if there's a prenuptial agreement.
True?
Yes, there is.
Okay.
So to say that it's a congregational will, and that it's clearly, and I really think that this discussion we have in the city, really you should speak to the Vada Rabboni of the city, because I think that if you spoke to the rabbis of the Vada Rabboni, you would probably find that the vast majority are totally opposed to prenuptial agreements and tell the members of their congregation.
I believe it. I think it's grounded in a sociology in which talking about divorce people think leads to divorce. I'm not even in opposition to this. I just reiterate Rabbi Lamb's saying, which is communities get the rabbinate that they deserve, which is I have no problem with this. But this is I repeat to you that which I tell you halachically, which I know is on very firm ground. There is no halachic opposition to the use of simple prenuptial agreements. One or two of the details of one or two of the prenuptial agreements are a little bit farther out on the limb, but the simple submission agreement, which is husband and wife agree, should there be any dispute about the giving or receiving of a gift, they agree to submit this matter to Beis Din X. That's without any halachic complications at all. Rabbinic opposition to these agreements come bottom up, meaning congregants say, poof, 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 we talk about divorce, it'll bring an ayin hara. So I have no problem with not having prenuptial agreements in that context, except I say to you only that then don't complain about the consequences. Meaning, you know, in my view, people are.
I think it's not nearly, at least not in Toronto, it's not nearly as binary as that. If anything, in the what I'll call the Das Torah community orthodoxy, while rabbis might not have ultimate legislative authority, they have phenomenal persuasive authority. And the communities of the kind, well, that can use me more than we're talking about. That just that's a one of the Das Torah communities.
Your comment is very astute, which is people choose to live in these communities. This is the ultimate assertion of freedom. People like it there. I say to you the following thing. You know, when the polio vaccine first came out, the government didn't mandate that anybody be vaccinated. Some people got vaccinated, some people didn't. And after 5 years, you know what it turned out? The people who got vaccinated didn't get polio. The people who didn't get vaccinated, you know what happened? Some of them got polio, some of them didn't. I'm not interested in fixing the world's problems coercively. If prenuptial agreements are a good idea, and they are, we'll start in our community. We will show that prenuptial agreements prevent the problem. Eventually, that will migrate to other communities successfully. Because people, one of these common things about humanity is people love their children intensely, and they desire to do that which is best for their children. It's a common social characteristic among mammals, humans particularly. And if prenuptial agreements work in our community, such that in 10 years, the Aguna problem in our community is very small. Other communities with other orientations will see this and imitate. So I don't doubt at all that people by choice choose to affiliate with communities with heavy Das Torah. Anybody in any religious community in any place in the United States can move. It's not at all like Europe, where you needed, the Aruch HaShulchan writes in Hilchos Nedarim, that to leave the Jewish community in Novartek, you needed a letter from the Aruch HaShulchan, or you could convert to Christianity and get a letter from the bishop. Those were your two options. You couldn't just not like the Aruch HaShulchan, so you'd move someplace else.
You can have your wedding in the church tomorrow.
Okay. I just say to you as follows, that even in heavy hierarchical authoritative communities, and I'm not so naive as to think they don't exist, the authority is voluntarily accepted. Anybody, you could wake up tomorrow and join that community. It would take you 30 days to grow the beard, and in 90 days you'd fit in, and the reverse. Anybody in that community wants to join this community, all they need to do is buy a shaver. Maybe not even. Okay? But do you understand what I'm saying to you? If we have a solution to the Aguna problem, let's not worry about imposing it on everybody. Let's start by building our own community in a way that successfully addresses the Aguna problem. That way we can turn to people and say, look, this solution works. You want to know why this solution works? Because here's a list of everybody in our community who signed one, and you go through it, and divorce happens, and there's no Aguna problems. There's a database running in New York about this, prepared by a number of different organizations. It shows that the number of days between the times the husband and wife separate and a get is issued is dramatically shorter if there's a prenuptial agreement about a get. How much dramatically shorter? Statistically, it's almost 18 months. Okay, and there are no open files in the Aguna, in the cases with prenuptial agreements. I don't have to think that I'm in charge of the whole world. I have no interest in fixing this problem coercively. Rabbis who are opposed to the prenuptial agreements shouldn't use them. And I'm not here to change anybody's mind. I'm here to do something much simpler. I believe they work. If you believe they work, then let's put together a community of people who believe they work, and then let's run our sociology with these agreements. After 10 years in which we are illness-free, others will see this and they will imitate. And over time, the truth that we have will be demonstrated to be true and will be followed. So I'm not so naive as to think that we'll fix this problem throughout the world immediately. If what I'm telling you about prenuptial agreements is true, that it works.
But even in the non-monarchical scene, rabbis have to bring this to their words, they have to influence their words, they have to lobby. Since we have,
so I'm here.
We have fully 66 2/3% of the monarchical rabbinate in Toronto in the living room right now. I mean, they have, you know, that's, it has to go to the board and they can influence.
So you have to start somewhere. I don't have answers for you. I don't have answers for you, but that's the way it gets started. It gets started by people doing this and other people seeing that the vaccine works. And then they lovingly impose it on their own children because everybody desires for their children to be the best.
I just want to preface this question to the people here is that Rabbi Broyd and I are old friends and colleagues, so you shouldn't think that I'm under the deck looking in.
Could be true even though we're friends and colleagues.
Now I know you're old friends.
Later year teacher, Hadono Shol Lieberman Zatzal, worked out a Tanai to be put in the Ketubah, which is no different than putting other Tanai, like Sephardi put a Tanai that somebody will marry a second wife, indicating exactly what you're saying, designating a Bet Din, etc. And in 1958, at least in English, there's a line from Hebrew, but the English article criticizing this on a number of halakhic grounds is written by Rabbi Norman Lamb.
Sure.
Has Rabbi Norman Lamb changed his view?
No, this has much to do with the desire to put it in the ksuva and to tinker with various texts and with the technical problems of the Bezdin that it was referred to. Everybody, look, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Igros Moshe writes explicitly, it's in the fourth Chayuk of Eben Ezer, it's Tshuva number 106, says right off the bat, without any hesitation, that an agreement between a husband and a wife to submit any dispute they have to Bezdin X is without any halakhic consequences and problems. So, to me, all of this is obvious. You want to have technical discussions about, is the rabbinic tradition to put it in the ksuva? Is it good to put it? Is it better to put it someplace else? Should it be written in Hebrew? Should it be written in English? All of these, in my view, are bad things. I think that Rabbi Lieberman's decision to put it in Hebrew in the ksuva was bad for many, many, many different reasons, and I would never do that. I don't think the ksuva is an enforceable document in American law, and I thus think that the decision to put the prenuptial agreement in the text of the ksuva jeopardizes its enforceability. And even though New York State, in a famous 4-3 decision, said, no, it is enforceable, no other state court has reached a similar conclusion. And so I'm against putting them in the ksuva because, in general, the text of the ksuva is not a legally enforceable document. You should take, instead, a piece of lined paper, write in English, and write on top of it, binding arbitration agreement, and follow the rules found in, you know, the Federal Arbitration Act, and ensure that it's enforced in American law. So the broad question of are these good was never addressed by Rabbi Lamb. The narrow question of should we put it in the ksuva, should we put it in Hebrew, should we put it in the context of the ksuva itself, all of these, to be honest, in my view, Rabbi Lieberman's decision from 40 years ago, we're wrong. We're wrong. And the ksuva is a bad document to put him in. And Rabbi Lieberman's decision to put it into the ksuva itself reflects a certain European mindset. about the ksuva will be legally enforceable.
It is in Canada.
I find that astonishingly hard to believe. A husband and wife refuse to live together, and the husband sues, saying the ksuva requires ona. And you're going to stand here and tell me that a Canadian court will open up a Shulchan Aruch to determine what are the ona requirements between a husband and wife, since it's in a binding contract.
No, a Canadian court, the Supreme Court of Manitoba, in Morris versus Morris, ruled that because a man had signed, agreed to a ketubah, et cetera, that this was considered to be binding and by implication required him to give a gift to his wife.
So that's a very... That's a very, you know, the I signed a ksuva, thus I agree to be divorced Jewishly. That's an old line of argument. That's, on, in my view, silly, halachic grounds. But neither here nor there. Why not make it explicit? Sign a prenuptial, a binding arbitration agreement, taking the central provision of a vitzur out and putting it in English. Nothing is gained putting it in a ksuva. Much is jeopardized and lost.
Could people do it any time during their marriage?
No, you have to sign arbitration agreements of this type normally before you're married. Okay, now it varies from state to state, and this is a matter of American contract law, so that I can contractually agree to resolve disputes, marital disputes before we're married or when we're married. In New York State, postnups are not legally binding. I don't know enough Canadian law to answer this question.
But your description of the idea, not of a prenup in a sense, but in the which you explained to me was this agreement that after the divorce,
right,
you get, that's not a prenup.
That's so this depends on whether contract law in Canada requires consideration or not. In American law, an agreement between the two of us with no consideration is void. So in American law, the consideration normally given in an agreement signed before we get married is to get married. New York State has a famous law which says agreements between husbands and wives during their marriage, governing the end of the marriage, are void because there's no consideration, because the consideration to stay married is not considered enough. Okay, now Georgia has a law which says that's not true. You can have postnuptial arbitration agreements. But it's a very complicated question. I don't know enough Canadian law to know what's the status of an agreement between a husband and a wife entered into after they're already married. So I can't answer. These are the kinds of questions. If you want to implement this in a structured way, I'm the wrong person. You have to find five Canadian family law lawyers who actually know the details of Canadian family law. Okay, and then you have to take the things that were designed in America, bring them here, and look at them, and tinker with them, and insert the requisite, you know, bells and whistles to make them work here. I don't know how to do that.
I challenge George. I organize a meeting.
I will participate in a committee. Yeah. I will not only that, I will commit myself to dealing with them on a regular basis to produce documents that are suitable for Canada.
I've been back and forth with the family lawyers on this less represented
so
for years. They have shot down every version
so
of the document.
So I will deal with them. I will deal with them on a prenuptial level. We will craft a text that's suitable. This takes time, but I'm glad to work diligently with them. I've worked with lawyers in California and a California prenup. California differs from almost every state in America because it's a communal property state with a different set of laws. So,
I think in fairness it needs to be said to this group, and it needs to be clarified or reiterated something that you said in the early part of your remarks, that the classic prenuptial agreement that is publicized by the Orthodox Caucus, that is on all the websites, that's in all the newspapers, that they talk about the National Coalition for the Gay, that's been the hype and the hoopla of the Orthodox community, doesn't work in Canada. And no family lawyer will accept it.
Right, this is a problem here. The prenup that was designed for New York State has limitations. You shouldn't be surprised by this. It doesn't work in all 50 states in America. It's not legal in Canada. You know what? It's not legal in California. Okay? It's not legal in Delaware. they get tinkered and modified.
Yeah, I guess the question is it not legal in a fundamental way or not legal because it is detailed?
The one from the Orthodox Caucus is not legal in a fundamental way.
But there are...
It's a prenup and it doesn't have financial disclosure.
Canada requires, as do five or six American states, that prenups require financial disclosure. So there are ways, you know, the simple way to avoid this, which is what we do in California, is we sign what's called a binding arbitration agreement, which says as follows. A husband agrees that within 30 days of a civil divorce, he will give a get to his wife. And wife agrees within 30 days of a civil divorce, she will receive a get from husband. And should wife not receive and husband not give a get within 30 days of a civil divorce, they agree that this matter will be submitted to the Beis Din made up of blank, blank, and blank, as chosen by Rabbi blank. Okay? And that's not a prenup, because it... I'm sorry? It's just a binding arbitration agreement. It doesn't govern the secular marriage at all because it doesn't kick in till the secular marriage is over. It's a very well-crafted document. I am sure you can craft such a document in Canada. It might be that the preamble has to be changed to say, you know, by the graces of the Queen or whatever you say in Canadian documents.
Consideration for that is what?
You say in Canada, in California, we say... through the exchange of $5. We generate artificial consideration. Okay, it's very simple. You know, all of these are just, you know, there's a formula in California for how to generate...
By the way, for the rapist, listen, I'm not going to do the rapist, but the rapist is a wonderful tool to explain the process of the chuppah. Because I use the concept of consideration to explain what the chuppah is all about.
Okay.
It works both ways.
Can I ask what you recommend?
I don't know. These are questions of local evidence law. Do you understand? I don't have answers for you. In New York State, you hardly need to hold the prenup because you will have a picture of the signing of the prenup. Meaning, local evidence law varies very much as to who needs to hold what. How necessary is it to produce an original? Will a photocopy do? I don't know enough Canadian law to know the question of do I need three originals or six originals? Can I just, what I do with all of my prenups is I fax it to the Beis Din and they put it in the file. I am confident in the United States that a faxed copy of a contract gets admitted in 30 years. For me to sit here and tell you how to do this in Canadian law would be far out of my league. So I just don't have, these are the kinds of questions that you have to put forward through a lawyer's committee and not a rabbi who's a lawyer in another state far away who comes here for a couple of hours. So I have a different observation. It has to be part of weddings.
Right.
Once it's at weddings, people will start talking about it in high school because they'll go over what to do when you get married, since that's a recurring theme, at least of girls' high schools.
You mentioned that you've got a database which records how many of these weddings in these 18 months left to be.
It's not yet statistically significant enough to publish it. The Orthodox Caucus has a sociologist who's preparing a paper proving this, and we want to do this, and everybody's looking to do this right. So the answer is that eventually it'll come forward. There are very complicated statistical modeling questions, so I don't have answers for you. You're now asking, how do I know that this is statistically significant? So I'll leave that to others. I'll give you my experiential answer. It's statistically significant. Okay? Am I sure that my social experiences are reflective of the whole? No, but I've sat on so many cases that my experiential observations can't be so far off. Okay?
Rabbi Shulman, does this mean that nobody who has received a prenuptial agreement up till now in Toronto has anything that's really worth anything legally?
See,
that's one of the reasons why a year and a half ago I stopped using them. And I used them all the years that I was in Calgary, and I used them for a few years that I was here, first 2 years. And then, and I used to fight with the family lawyers. I used to say, just, there's two problems. Problem of one, the issue of disclosure. Problem number two is that you can't sign a prenup without sending it to the family lawyers, because Canada requires a declaration of independent legal counsel. Like each side in the marriage has to have a lawyer sign a statement that says they've given counsel. And without that statement of the lawyer, the document's not valid. So the lawyer, I spoke to Trevor Willard about this 2 years ago, and he said to me, the moment you have to get, you'll pardon the lawyers here, will pardon me. The moment you have to sign the lawyers, don't use it.
But you see, this is just an argument against this text. I'm not here to defend this text. And so I have a database with seven distinctly different prenuptial agreements, and you get a different prenuptial agreement depending on your own construct.
But this is not what's publicly discussed, and at all the RCA conventions, the only document they've ever presented to the rabbinate.
So I can't answer this for you. Whenever I do these presentations, I honestly didn't find out I was doing a presentation on prenuptial agreements until Friday. I bring along with you the seven texts that I give out. There are seven texts out there that are good. There are seven distinctly different texts. Each of them has a different bell and a different whistle. But you have to pick the one that works. Please. So there's a field of law called conflicts of law that addresses questions of this type. It's, you know, a 5-credit law school course, and so you'll have to take it. You only got 3/5 of what you need to know. I mean, it's a hard question, but it's a very detail. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. I had a very nice time.
Yeah.
Let's turn it off.